with Mark Scholl, who is a county commissioner for Clackamas County that we're trying to recall, and another woman, Heinemann Allen, who is also, she's running against one of the people in Clackamas, on the Clackamas County Commission. Be careful who you vote for, and know that there's a lot of the militia running for office with the support of the Republican Party in the state. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Oh, could you repeat those races again?
Mark, he's running for governor, and he's going to speak at this fundraiser for Dan Tews, who is running for state rep District 40. And Dan is a known militia member. Also, Mark Scholl, who is a county commissioner for Clackamas County, who right now is, we're trying to recall him because he's a racist and an Islamophobe. And Dana Heinemann Allen is speaking at this event, and she is running against Sonia Fisher, who is on the county commission. She's one of the good guys on the county commission. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so there's other people speaking. I don't know, can't speak to them, what they are. But anyway, this is a right-wing speaking event, and we need to be really aware of who these people are and what they stand for. So anyway,
I totally agree. I would like to, I will try to find, maybe if you could, I don't know if you could, I'll try to find a link to listing all these candidates, and maybe I'll do a show looking at them in detail, because I agree, this is part of their strategy, is to just they're really running everywhere, all of these folks, these really right-wing extremist folks, even QAnon supporters have made it to Congress, you know, but they're running at every level, and to be aware and be educated about that is really important. So I think it's the end of the show now. I'd love to thank you for calling in, Sue and Arthur. And I'm Jackson Keeler.
The Bluegrass Marathon, Saturday, March 19th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on KBOO. See you there.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 1 special programming campaign. This is the last week of All Thrills, No Frills, and we need your help to reach our $15,000 goal by March 19th. Support KBOO now at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks so much for your support.
Welcome to Between the Covers, interviews about books with the people who write them, here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Avi Marr, your host this week. Willie Flotten is the author of The Motel Life, Lean on Pete, Don't Skip Out on Me, The Free, Northline, and most recently, The Night Always Comes. The Motel Life and Lean on Pete were both made into films. The Night Always Comes has also been optioned for film. Welcome to Between the Covers, Willie Flotten.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So to start out, I wanted to talk about place is such a defining characteristic of your work. Can you talk a little bit about Reno as the place that started you out and what you saw change and what its character put into you?
I mean, I just always loved it there. You know, I think as a kid, it's just a place like any other. And I didn't, my mom hated casinos. I lived with my mom and my brother. And so I didn't understand any of that part of that aspect of Reno. I loved it. I loved the high desert. We, you know, it's right on the foothills of Sierra. So as a kid, it was gorgeous. But when I was like 13 or 14, when I started realizing that I guess I just was a little beat up and a little edgy. And you know, at that age, you start coming into your own with it. And I think at that age, and then at the same time, I started working for my mom at the airport. And I worked with a lot of alcoholic men during the summers. And I just started seeing this other side of Reno, this real beat up driftery, and it was, at that time, it was mostly all men, you know, it was kind of like alcoholic, driftery, gambleholic men that ended up living in motels in Reno. And my mom would give these guys rides home sometimes, and she'd talk about them. And I just said, man, I feel like those guys. And I was like 12 or 13. It wasn't like I wanted to drink or whatever, but I just felt like those guys at that age. And so I knew I was born to the right town for the way my soul felt. That sounds crazy, but I felt really comfortable with that, with those kind of ideas. I was scared to death of them, but I was also really drawn to it. So I always felt I was just born to the right town. It was beat up in a way that a certain side of that town is beat up. It's a normal city like any other.
Yeah.
But there was an edge to it that I really gravitated towards, especially when around like 16, 17, 18. I thought I would be a bum. And so I started hanging out at old man bars. You know, I had a big edge on me. So I just fell in love with Reno. And I think I used to hang out at this bar called the Last Dollar Saloon, and with these old, like an old drunk lady who dressed like like she was in the Misfits, the Misfits, you know, real dapper lady. Like you wouldn't know she was probably 60. You wouldn't know she was homeless until she opened her mouth with like three teeth in there. But I felt really comfortable around those kind of people. At the same time, I was terrified that I was gonna end up like them, but I wanted to be one of them. So I was one of those. From very early age, I've always been one foot in, destroying myself, and one foot out of, you know, work hard, stay out of trouble. So I was just in love with Reno, and I've always loved novels and movies and records that can transport you, and their sense of place is really strong. So I just started writing about Reno because I was in love with it.
Hmm. Do you think that sensibility, like, I love this idea that you're saying, there was some way that you like resonated with these drunk old guys? Is it like this sort of, I guess I want to find out a little bit more about it. Like, was that sort of deep romantic sadness, or what was it about them? What, can you put words on it?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was some dumb kid romantic sadness stuff in there, but it was also like they gave up
mm.
and they gave up, and they're hiding, and they disappeared, and they just said, look, I can't do it. The world's too rough. I'm going to sit in a bar and drink. And that was really attractive to me as a kid, I think. I mean, I think it, you know, I didn't like being a kid at all.
Mm.
And it was that escape. And there's a romantic side to that, sure. You know, it's not until you're like 30, 35, sitting in one of those bars next to a guy that's like drank his life away, and you're like, holy hell, get me out of here. I don't want to be that guy. It's romantic to be around what you'd call an old man, like a 50-year-old alcoholic, when you're snuck in and 17, you find out he's been in prison, and he's like got two ex-wives, whatever, and he lives above in a room above the bar, and you think, man, that guy's free. And then when you get in your 30s and booze has got you, and you realize, no, man, that guy just wasted his life and probably just left a, you know, a wake of misery around him, that you spend the rest of your life trying to run away from that bar.
Yeah.
The same bar that's those same kind of guys that you're really attracted towards, and that lifestyle, it both attracts you, and then you spend the rest of your life, you know, trying to go jogging.
You've said before that you were writing stories already as a kid.
And I wrote songs 10, 11. You know, my brother was a guitar player and wrote songs in high school. He was 4 years older than me. And so I pretty much just did whatever he did. And I didn't really like playing guitar, and I didn't understand it. And then my brother said, he did two things. He got me a left-handed guitar, or he had my mom get me a left-handed guitar, because I was a real lefty and I couldn't figure out how to play right.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're such a sad kid, it seems like. Why don't you write songs about it? So I just started writing pretty much the kind of songs I write now, but, you know, obviously much worse, you know, ill-informed and all that. But I love the idea of disappearing into it. I love disappearing into music. And I never understood I didn't get the memo on the rock star being in front of people, that aspect. Like I didn't ever, that never... wasn't attracted to that aspect of it all. It was the drug of disappearing. that I love so much about music. And you know, the playing in front of people and that aspect about has about killed me throughout my life, but because I'm so shy. But the music part, man, I just loved it. So yeah, from say 11 on, I wrote obsessively songs. I mean, really tried hard at it. I really sucked, like most kids, but I was really bad and with no talent. And then the same thing with stories. I started writing stories because it just took, you know, you bother people less when you write stories. You know, when you live in an apartment or have roommates and you're writing bad songs and you have a bad voice, you really do start annoying people. I drove my mom nuts with it. And so writing, you know, is a way to disappear where you didn't bother anybody and it's cheap. And you don't have to be in, and you don't have to go beg to play some bar where people make fun of you. You just hang out in your room and disappear for long periods of time. It's like a long extended drug. And so 17, 18, I started like writing obsessively. Just again, for the same thing, just so I could live in a different world. So, you know.
So what was the, what made the shift from, this was, it's a one person world you're describing. What was the shift that let you show them to anybody, show your writing to anybody?
A couple things, you know, I mean, when I was, by the time I was say 21 or so, I'd written a lot of stories. I mean, I really wrote a lot of stuff, both songs and stories. You know, I think I took a night class in Reno, a few of them, from at the university, and the lady was really nice. She used to read my stories to her boyfriend. And she was really cute. I'm still friends with her. I just went to her retirement party, but I had a, you know, she's probably, hell, I think she was probably 35 or so. And really, like, you know, like, you're not an idiot or a freak. You're one of the chosen ones. She would tell her class because, you know, she dressed like what you'd imagine a poet would dress like. And she just kept telling me, you're not a freak. You know, you've found the greatest thing in the world, which is literature. And then she would read my stories to her boyfriend, or I guess it was her soon to be ex-husband at that point. And I was like, man, she's probably like in her underwear or in her nightgown reading my stories. And I was just like, so I was like, I just started writing them for her. And then she was like, you should send them out. And so I started sending out and I started getting them published like in my early 20s. And I was so embarrassed because they were so bad. That after that, I pretty much quit sending stuff out for 15 years. And I quit. I showed like old buddies of mine. Like I have a couple guys that I grew up with or I met in my early 20s that liked literature. And so I just gave it to them and see if they'd think it was cool. And that was about it till I was about 35. And then, you know, my band started doing better and people started asking, you know, they started saying, hey, I bet you write stories and novels. And I said, hey, yeah, I do. And that's kind of how I got published from Richmond Fontaine, got me published.
Oh, I didn't know that it was, but it also sounds like the same way you talk about with music, you don't put yourself forward. When someone asked you is what happened, like people started to figure out you have a novelistic way of singing. Do you have anything else? And then that pushed you over the line to?
Well, I mean, my confidence got bigger. Yeah. So around 23, or I guess I was 25 or 6, I quit sending stuff out and I quit showing anybody. But I didn't stop writing. You know, I'd quit jobs to write novels. And then I'd work for a couple years, save up my, you know, I'd start a mutual fund and bust it and, you know, and then I'd quit and use all that money to write novels that I never showed anybody. And then, so I kept working hard. But, you know, being in a band when you're as shy as I was, with no confidence at all, like my confidence, you know, I drank my confidence for, you know, years and years and years. And so I think around 35, I'd written like three or four novels. And Richard Fontaine started doing better in Europe. And I started doing more and more interviews. And a lot of guys that interview you are you know, writers. And I did an interview with a crime writer in London once, and he was a really cool guy. We hit it off, and you know, we're still friends. And he said, "I bet you write novels." And I go, "How'd you know?" And we talked. We had similar tastes in books. And he goes, "Well, hey, I'm gonna invite my agent to your gig tomorrow, and you should talk to her." And so she was really, really cool. And I think she'd had a couple of drinks and was said, "I'll read your stuff. Yeah, why not?" And then I had to make that decision. You know, do I want? Yeah. Do I want to see if I suck? You know, my band would get beat up. You know, like you do when you're doing stuff for people, you get beat up sometimes. And I didn't want to do that to my writing because I liked writing so much. I didn't want to feel like a loser. I felt really responsible anytime Richmond Fontaine was doing badly. It was my fault. I knew it because it was my songs and my voice. So I felt really responsible for it, and I didn't want to subject that to my books. But she was really cool. They had this agent, and I sent her The Motel Life.
Was it The Motel Life you sent?
Yeah, and she goes, "Look, I can, you know, I'd love to represent you." And I still work with her to this day. She's Yeah, she's super cool and really nice and tough. Like, she can stick the knife in you and you still want to take her out to dinner afterwards. Yeah, she's really cool. And she sold it. So and then my life changed that way. So I guess you get to that thing where you're either, you want your book in the library next to all the other books more than you're scared of people hating it. At the end of the day, I wanted the guys in The Motel Life to be in a library somewhere next to all the other books. So I took a chance.
So one of the interviews I read with you that I thought was fascinating is one of the things you were saying that helped you get to putting your stuff out was when you started reading people like Raymond Carver and Jim Thompson. And one of the things that you said was, when you started reading writers that wrote about broken people, and the writers were broken people writing about broken people, but there was something about that shift away from just a different kind of writer writing about broken people that was meaningful to you, that helped you feel more able to put your stuff out. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult if you don't have a lot of confidence. I wasn't a great student. I did get lucky in school, and then John Steinbeck was a big, I read, you know, most of his major works in middle school and high school, and, you know, studied them. They were like assigned. And I was in love with him, man. I mean, I still have his picture by my bed. I've had a picture by my bed of him since I was 13 or something. Cause he had such kindness with broken people. And people that weren't getting a fair shake, or people that would shoot themselves in the foot. There was a side of him that I really liked, and he brought me comfort. I'm not talking about literature now. I'm talking about a guy's story helping you get through the day.
Yeah, I was concerned.
You can argue about Steinbeck and his place amongst the greats of literature, but as a kid and still to this day, he makes my life easier when I think about certain stories of his. So, but again, he went to Stanford, and, you know, he was a really amazing guy, and I wasn't. And then when I was 18, I read through a musician named Paul Kelly, an Australian, you know, really literary kind of Bob Dylan. They call him the Bob Dylan of Australia. He's a genius, really amazing songwriter. He had an obsession with Carver for a record, and he wrote a song called "Everything's Turning to White," and based on a Raymond Carver story, "So Much Water, So Close to Home." And I heard that song, and I love the story so much. And at the bottom it said, "Inspired by a short story by Raymond Carver." So I bought this "Where I'm Calling From" by Raymond Carver, and I was living with my girlfriend in her parents' garage, and I didn't have a job, and I felt like a real bum. And then I just read that book, and it about killed me, because Carver, again, literary things aside, to me, what I got out of Carver at that age was, here's a guy that's been propped up by women his whole life, like, you know, most of the women are strong, and that was the case in my life. And I really bad with the booze, which wasn't really my case. I wasn't as bad a drunk as him, but flawed and self-hating, and nothing really happens in the stories. It's not like small little wounds. And I really related to that. And it really changed my life as far as thinking that I could write stories. I was like, I didn't know you could write about bad men that aren't that bad. It just like, they just can't get to work that day, and their wife works is the manager at Denny's and she pays all the bills and that sort of stuff. And then I read Larry Brown, who's like a kind of a more, I'd say open-hearted and more, has more blood in him. Like there's more romance and more fight, I think, in Larry Brown. And I really identified with him. And then I started reading like David Goodis and Charles Williford and Jim Thompson, these guys that were really kind of wild, beat up, psychologically beat up guys writing about psychologically beat up people. And then because I have that edge in me, probably stronger than even Larry Brown or Carver's edge in me. And so those guys, you know, because those guys are like punk rock. They just do their things their own way, and they don't care. So I gravitated towards those guys, and I've always tried to write in between all that, those kind of influences.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like partly it gave you permission. I hear what you're saying, that there's a confidence issue that when you felt like really moved by somebody in a way that you recognized, that actually let you take your next step.
Yeah, of course. You know, you feel comfortable. I mean, I felt really at home in a lot of Carver stories, and I felt at home in most of Larry Brown's stories. And then, you know, as you start, and probably I felt the safest, and this is a crazy thing to say, in Jim Thompson or Charles Williford. Like, God, those guys, I'd stay up all night reading those guys because they're just maniacs. And I just loved it. And then as I, you know, as I started getting in deeper, guys like William Kennedy, Ironweed, you know, was like kind of the book that I really wanted to write, because Kennedy has a lot of love in him and a lot of soul, and a lot of light. But in his veins is pure darkness too. So he's got all that stuff kind of working together, and he's brilliant. And you know, so he's always been probably my biggest, Ironweed's probably what I always want to write. I'm not smart enough to write a book that good, but that's kind of my dream, because that has everything. Where Carver, for me, is like, I can't read Carver anymore because he's so dark to me. I want to have more light in me, in my stories. And so Kennedy's always been my guy. Ironweed's always been my guy as far as like, what I always aspire to. I always read that book. I read that or Fat City every time I'm about ready to finish a book to see, you know, did I try as hard as I could? Yeah. Did I try as hard as these guys tried? And then usually I have to go back for another year and tinker more. But that's okay. That's, you know, that's the gig. The thing that I love about writing is you don't have to be the best at it. If it takes you 20 tries to get it right once, no one needs to know that. And so that's what's given me, you know, that's why I love writing. It's frustrating, you know, to edit, but it's also like, it says to me, like, you don't have to be the smartest guy. You just have to work harder. I'm sure there's guys that, you know, that are brilliant and work hard. Like William Kennedy. I mean, I think he's a master with language. Whether you like his stories or not, that's an aesthetic kind of thing. But he's really great with language. So you take a guy like that that's really driven. And so those are the guys that, the people that do the best are the ones that are brilliant and work hard.
Yeah.
You know, and the rest of us, you know, we're, you know, slogging it out. Yeah, you got to try as hard as you can, you know, just being you, which is, you know, just.
Well, it sounds like part of what's appealing to you is this, is the oppositions, like like you can go really dark, but you need that level of light. And that's sort of what I read in your stuff is, I mean, we'll talk about it a little bit more after. I was going to ask you to read, but I think that's kind of sounds like what you wrestle with when I read what you're writing, you know, that it gets really dark, but there's this sort of little light someone's keeping on as they keep, you know, marching into a darker and darker room.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, I do have a dark mind. I always have, I think it goes back to, it's pretty, you know, simple for me really, which is there's the part of me that wants to disappear into the old man bar, and there's part of me that's running as fast as I can from it. And I've been that way since I was a little kid in different regards. So for me, you know, my tendency is like I like darker stories, but you need the light to save your life, you know. And so, you know, a lot of my stories are a battle between trying to save your own life in a way. So you know, I learned early on, if you want the hard parts, the hard story, hard difficult parts of a story to resonate, you gotta invite people in. I always think of this band I liked when I was a kid. And the guys were really weird guys. They're just like a local band. And the guys didn't like each other. They were the kind of guys that would probably tortured rats in the basement kind of guys, you know? They were just like creepy guys that would like probably punch their sister while she's walking to the bathroom, you know, going to school. Just a weird kind of like grungy. Yeah, I think I've summed them up. So you see it, but they were brilliant. The guy was wrote great lyrics and they were playing, but no one ever liked him. And I kept thinking, man, why doesn't anybody like them? And then I was with this friend, and after that band, we went and saw like a jam band, every band, and everybody's happy and everybody's enjoying it. I was like, and they, you know, they wrote some good songs too. But I was thinking, oh man, they let you in. The jam band, they liked each other. Like it felt warm in the room. And then you're like, oh, I get it. So, and then they could stick the knife in you. They could say they could tell some really dark stories, but people would come in and sit down and listen to them. Where these other, these, you know, baby killers and the other band, they were too scary. They couldn't let you in. It was so dark. And so I kind of learned that the hard way, which is, you know, you got to invite people in. And then tell your story, but you can't scare them too much. It has to have light in it, or it's not real. And it's off-putting. So I've always battled with that, and so I've always thought about those guys when I'm writing stories, you know. So I'll write a story, and then I always take about a third of the drink. If there's drinking in the novel, I always take about a third out. And then I take about a third of the darkness out, you know, because some of it's just me being me, and some of it needs to be there.
Well, that was one of the questions that I had, was about, you know, you do alcohol so well in your writing. And
thank you. I did something right. Hey.
Is it you wrestling with your demons around addiction or your family's demons around addiction? And this is where I want to be careful around your privacy around... you know, is that part of what gets played out when you try to look at somebody trying to survive and somebody trying to escape and something getting darker? Is that one of the things that you bring into a fictional world?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're going to spend, you know, and again, I write not even thinking they're going to be published, or that's like the least of my concerns until it's kind of too late, actually.
Yeah.
But like, especially the early, like the more kind of heavy drinking books, which would be Motel Life and Northline in particular. I was, you know, I'm interested in that. With the Motel Life, I was interested in two brothers that have kind of slid through life and never had to really stand up and have kind of like shirked any kind of difficult or demanding situation. They're always kind of sliding away. And you know, most of the guys I grew up were like that. Myself included. And then you ask, how do you stand up? when you're asked to, when those guys have to, and it's ugly. So with them, it was, you know, I was writing about drinking so I wouldn't drink. Mm. I was also writing about drinking because that's all I ever did. And then with Northline, I was interested in anxiety. You know, with Allison Johnson, I was interested in the idea of weakness, of being so weak and hating yourself so much, and being so shy that you kind of just, you know, drinking's, you know, one of the ways that people like that survive, especially pre, you know, pharmaceuticals. And so I was interested in that aspect of it as well. When your crutch is for the Flanagan brothers, the crutch alcohol is a long term. It's slowly cutting their feet off and their legs slowly. But with her, it just kind of sucker punches her when she drinks. She's just not good at it. But I was interested in her still having to rely on it. It's a wicked friend. I think booze is always a wicked friend, but it's just like, it's just to some people it's a you know, grizzly bear, and then to other people it just starts out as a puppy pit bull, you know, and then you wake up one day and it's like got your
you're
neck
in
and it's not. Yeah.
Well, it's another interesting thing when you talk about, I think you were talking about this book, but you were talking about like, I spent this much time writing it, I think you had like a second half of it that you decided wasn't working or whatever, but you, one of the ways you were talking about your editing process or your reworking process is, so I stopped drinking, like that's the first sentence.
Oh yeah.
I did yoga, I started running. So it made me think about, like, you know, what's that process like? Like, is it, do you have this kind of cleanse phase, whatever you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was kind of, you know, like Richard Fontaine, we were hell raisers, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of my drinking has always been, I mean, I love it. It you know, I'm good at it, I guess, if you can be. But it made it so I could go in front of people. It made it so I could go to the grocery store, you know, all that kind of stuff as a kid. But I always had, I could always pull back, you know. I always, you know, my brother said my greatest gift is, like, you know, if I go, I get drunk 2 days in a row, I get a cold. And so I can't, my body can't take it. So as I get older, you know, I battle with it, and I've kind of, you know, I've kept it in its place more or less. But, you know, when you're writing a novel, you know, I don't, you know, writing a novel, like, for me, it's like, I'm not that smart a guy, so I have to like use everything I can to, you know, to try to think my way through a bad, like if I write myself into a bad situation. So usually what happens is I'll write a book, and I always take care of myself. I always say the same thing, which, and I apologize, but it's kind of true. Like if you see me and you go, God, it looks like he's been sleeping under a car, then you know I'm probably writing songs, and I'm not working on a novel. And if you're like, I think he looks skinnier, and, you know, he shaved, and he looks like he lives somewhere, and then you go, oh man, he's fine. I wonder what kind of book he's writing. So with writing, I always kind of take care of myself, because you just have to. When I hit panic, you know, like I'm working on a book right now where it's just kind of like, you realize it's not that good, and it's not going well, then you have to start trying to change stuff. You know, and I go, my first thing is like, man, I was a house painter for years, and I probably lost a lot of my brain cells fumes. So I start getting mad at myself being a house painter. So a lot of self-hatred, I beat myself up for a while. And then you're like, all right, I'm gonna quit sugar, because they say sugar makes you dumb. And I'm already dumb, and I love donuts. So you're like, all right, I'll start there. And then you're like, only one beer. You can have one beer, maybe one shot of tequila, and that's it. And then you do that, and then you're like, you better start jogging again, and maybe you should like meditate. And then you do all that stuff in hopes that you get an ounce more, like just one more brain cell to fire, and you'll figure your book out. So it's usually, that's what it is. And then,
does it work?
No, I mean, you can write better, you can write longer. Like if you feel better, you can write longer, you can sit in a chair longer, you can,
yeah.
But I don't know, I mean, I think it does help. I mean, nothing, you know.
Yeah.
After a certain age, I mean, all a hangover does is you just watch more Rockford, and you eat more like fried chicken, and you don't answer any emails or phone calls, and you're mad at your dog because your dog won't lay next to you while you're watching, you know, your eighth hour of Rockford. You're like, come on, man. And he's like,
oh, you love me?
Yeah, can't we go out and do something? You're like, no, man, fried chicken's coming up, and you know, Jimbo's, you know, an angel. Can't we just lay in bed for it? So, you know, and then, you know,
yeah,
hangovers come the next day, comes, you know, the guy punching you, and the guy's punching you is yourself. And you know, that's a pain in the ass too, so.
All right, I think it's a good segue. Should we go to the night always comes? Would you read us a bit, sir?
Yeah, I mean, this is just a scene where Lynette gets her first, who's the main protagonist, gets her first boyfriend. Here's a woman who doesn't know how to love. I don't think she's ever really been loved properly. Mm-hmm. She's been with men, but she's never had a boyfriend, and a good boyfriend, like someone that treats her decently. And I was interested in the idea of what happens when you get a really traumatized person starts going out with an untraumatized person that's had a good family and a good upbringing, it's a good person. So here's just a little bit of that. Within 4 months, she spent 3 nights a week in his apartment and started taking birth control. They had sex nearly every time they saw each other. And for the first time in her life, she had orgasms. When she stayed at his place, he would wake her up with a cup of coffee. He would walk her to work at 6 and pick her up after she got off. He spent all his money on her. And after 5 months, he told her he loved her. He told her he wanted to marry her someday. Jack had a pickup truck. And each week when he got paid, he took her out to eat in a different part of town. They saw movies together. They got drunk together. And they saw bands play. They went roller skating at Oaks Park and ice skating at Lloyd Center. They walked in and out of high-end downtown stores. They spent weekend afternoons strolling through neighborhoods looking at houses they wanted to live in. They went to furniture stores and picked out furniture that would go in those houses. After 8 months, he drove her to Seaside for the day to meet his parents, and then Eugene, where his brother Henry was taking classes at the community college to be a mechanic. There was a gentleness to Jack that she could disappear into. Never once did he blindside her or intentionally try to hurt her. He would get nervous or grumpy, insecure or angry. But when he did, he would try to talk to her about it. He would try to explain himself to her, explain the way he felt. She introduced him to her mother and Kenny. And to Lynette's great relief, Jack liked Kenny. He wanted to spend time with her brother. So they began taking Kenny to lunch at the Sexton on Columbia River so he could watch the boats pass. They took him to the airport to see the planes take off, to stock car races, to baseball games, to the hot cake house, and to the horse track. Jack took them camping near Mount Hood. Neither she or Kenny had ever been camping before. They had never sat by a campfire. Jack was the first man that Kenny ever really liked. He was the first man Kenny ever ran to and hugged when he saw him. There were times when Lynette was certain that Jack had been sent by her grandfather to save her life. When they would go to the hot cake house, she would secretly pray to herself and thank her grandfather for remembering her and caring enough about her to bring Jack to her. Thank you, thank you, thank you, she'd say. But after a year, it started. The old Lynette would reappear. In those moments, her sadness and hopelessness and anger would rush past her like a speeding car. It nearly broke her when it first happened, because she realized she hadn't rid herself of who she'd been. She hadn't rid herself of herself. And once she knew that, it became a fog that chased her, a fog that would never completely disappear. At first, she was able to keep it under control because it only came up when she was tired, sick, or too drunk. Over time, though, it took more and more work. She began to having to force herself to act happy. She told Jack none of this because she was certain if he knew how much she struggled and what she was really like, he would leave her.
Oh, breaks my heart every time I hear it.
Yeah, man, that breaks my heart too.
Doesn't it? Just
yeah. You know, and I feel so bad for her because she has to act instead of. To cope with it, and you know, I think with Lynette, it's always been rage is her equal. It's how she hits reset buttons and how she gets control of her life is to rage, and she knows she's gonna pop on and rage at this really cool guy, and she can't stop it, and he has no idea what's going on. He's caught in the storm of a person that has a lot of hard miles underneath her that she's never let anybody. And see, it's a hard thing to do, especially if you've never been in a safe situation, to be able to do that. And she, you know, she, I would guess she grew up on movies and romance, and she doesn't want to admit, like, hey, I'm not this perfect girlfriend that's going to be with this perfect guy. I got a lot of baggage and I'm beat up. I don't think she was ready to admit that. And so, you know, when you're young, you think you can hide all that stuff and become some other person. And I don't think, I don't think she was really at that age could articulate the amount of pain that she was in or carrying with her.
That's the heartbreaking thing is she was happy with him. And then finding out she couldn't outrun it.
Yeah, it's hard when you can't outrun yourself. I mean, it's rough, man. I mean, everybody has to come to that on their own, in their own way. Some people keep outrunning it their whole lives, and I know guys that have never dealt with anything their whole life, and they compartmentalize, and it starts eating at them, and they know it's eating at them, but they just can't do it. Yeah. Maybe they can get through life without ever really dealing with stuff, but it takes, you know, there's a cost to be paid.
How did you decide to have it be a woman instead of a man? Who's the person?
Well, I was interested in a family that stuck together longer than they should. And I was interested a couple reasons. So it's a mother and an adult daughter who's 30, and then a developmentally disabled older brother who's 32, who's Kenny. I was interested in those three sticking together longer than they should, and they're sticking together because of Kenny. I thought if Lynette was a man, he would have left the family. He probably would have sent money, but he would have abandoned them. Maybe that's just my own take on men, but I think Lynette feels such guilt of how she's been to her mom and to her brother, maybe even, that she's decided to stay. And so I wanted this family dynamic where you have a person who still believes in trying the American dream of home ownership, of that you can work your way out of a bad economic situation. You can work so hard that you'll rise above. And then the mom saying, no, you can't. And so you meet the mom at that, she's already kind of cracked and it's falling apart. And she becomes the idea of, like, you know, just scrape by, you know, lie big, borrow steal kind of idea. But there's no use fighting it, and Lynette still wants to fight. So to me, having a woman would be the only way to make that story work. And also, I was interested in the idea of rage is a defense mechanism, and I thought that'd be much more interesting. And I was more interested in that, the power of that when a woman uses rage, in a weird sort of way, it's scarier, more scary than when a man uses rage. When a man uses rage, sometimes you're just like, man, he's just a bomb. You know, but when a woman uses rage, it seems more heavy to me and more complicated. And so I guess that's why I set it up the way I set it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was interested in that idea like with Lynette, she's really working, like she's real blue collar. She's not that educated. she's really narrow in how she can perceive of getting money. So I was really interested in that idea of what do you do when all of a sudden the housing prices increase so much, like everything increases so much that you can't work 24/7 working as a baker or a bartender and figure out how to make enough money just to own a house in the city. Mm-hmm. And so I was interested in a person also who's real stubborn, and she can't really see another way, like the way she's going is not going to work, and she can't see outside that because I don't think she knows better. So she just works and works and then ends up doing what people do when they need money and you do something illegal.
But I also think that's what makes it like the heart pounding pace of the book is her desperation.
Well, I was really interested in the idea of self sabotage. I think, you know, the when they have the opportunity to buy the house, the mom. She realized she's like, hey, you know, we're paying all this money for a house near a freeway that's pretty much a teardown. She doesn't buy into it. But part of that is she doesn't want to sacrifice anymore for the family. She doesn't want to sacrifice for her son anymore. She doesn't like her daughter. She doesn't want to live the rest of her life with her daughter. She doesn't want to give towards them to help them have a better life in the future. She's like, why not me? So part of the argument in the book is like me versus Lynette is saying, no, we have to care about community. We have to care about the family. And I think the mom's so beaten down too and has tried hard and failed in her own ways and really worked hard in her own ways. She's just like, I just want something shiny and nice. So when I drive down the street, I look cool and I feel like I'm important, that I've been successful at something. I've always been interested in that idea. And you know, with the rapid gentrification of Portland and the dramatic, jaw-dropping shift in this city in a short period of time, made that story, you know, kind of jump out at me.
The way that you, in the book, have these exploiting men, right, where they each exploit Lynette, you give them a chance to sort of defend themselves in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those the big battles of humanity that just, I guess as you get older, you get more cynical about it, which is that idea of powerful people taking advantage of weaker people with no power. And it happens time and time again. And there's such a pull in humanity to destroy any kind of any way of equalizing. Yeah. And so I think with Lynette, you see like probably the nicest man in it of those men is the old money Portland. So she first meets the old money guy who was just a businessman, but there's no love there, no kindness there. And then there's the new money guy she meets who, I mean, he's so rich, like an IT money rich guy, that he has somebody else. And I've painted houses like this, for guys like this, where they hire stylists to pick out their clothes. They hire stylists to decorate their house. They hire somebody to cook their meals for them. And they have no personality underneath it all. Like, they didn't pick the bad couch, you know, and they didn't pick the bad, you know, photograph that no one else likes, but they like. And that guy has no idea of humanity, of the pain he's putting this woman through. It's all about power to him and like what he can get away with. And then it goes down to like the criminal guy who just is like the guys that see, you know, they're all fine and good. And then they see the $100 on the ground and then they're like, oh man, that's me. It's like Treasure Sierra Madre kind of stuff where temptation corrupts a lot of people. And then you get the guy, the self-righteous guy, the repo guy, who says one thing and talks about how greed's bad and like you should only buy what you can pay for. And he takes advantage of her because he thinks he can. And he's got an angle like so many people do. You think and think and think until you find an angle that backs up your idea. And you're like, well, you know, I got this reason and this belief now that I deserve to take your money. one. So I think he just had to find it in his mind. So yeah, it's a night of like her going into like kind of the darker side of greed, which, you know, obviously is so interesting in Portland, like these, you know, kind of beat up neighborhoods, and then somebody buys a house, tears it down, builds a mansion near it, and then, you know, at the same time there's just cities of homeless people. It's a really interesting shift and frightening. And so sitting in St. John's, I'd look out the window and walk around, and you just can't help it. It just sinks into you. So I needed to write the story to try to figure out my ideas on it. Mm-hmm.
Did you like know that you wanted to write that going in, or did it sort of come out the way that it came out and then you saw the
I wanted pretty much all the things we talked about I was interested in before I started. I made a couple bad, you know, I always do. With this book, I wrote a whole other novel, really, where she and Kenny leave together, and it was, you know, it didn't work, and it took, you know, a year and a half of my life. And that was one of my, pull out the yoga DVDs, and like, my brother's always trying to get me to meditate, and I'm like, you know, I better do all this, you know, listen to my self-help tapes, so I can get together. But in the end, it's just, you know, I just had to cut that whole section out. I generally know what I want to do before I start, but I always make like, you know, a wrong turn in Albuquerque, and then I spent years trying to fix it. I wrote a book called Lean on Pete. That was one where I just kind of sat down and wrote it. It was a pretty simple story. And that one I didn't have to mess with too much. The rest of them were really hard. I wrote like an extra 300 pages to Don't Skip Out on Me. I wrote a whole other novel that was supposed to be in that novel. It just didn't work. So I've made some blunders along the way. Yeah, sure. But, you know, you just kind of stick with it and trust your gut. Mm-hmm. Just trust your gut until you're ready to let it go.
Is it true, you've talked before about you write a song and something about the song becomes the sort of North Star that turns into your novels?
Yeah, I mean, all my novels except for this one.
That's what I was going to ask. Is there a song?
No, I mean, my band did a soundtrack, the Delines did a soundtrack to it, with the paperback version, which comes out in May, has the soundtrack in it, or a link to it. But I wrote that afterwards. In general, all my books started as songs. It'd be an idea, like Lean on Pete started as a song. Mm-hmm. First with a song called Laramie, Wyoming by Richard Fontaine. And then I wrote a song called Lean on Pete because I used to bet on a horse named Lean on Pete at Portland Meadows and always won them. And the times I didn't bet on it, it would win. I mean, it was just like the one horse I always did get on. And so I wrote a song called Lean on Pete, which basically is the whole story. And, you know, it was a miserable, like, 7-minute folk song that never went anywhere.
Yeah.
Northline started as songs. Motel Life started as a bunch of songs. The Free started as songs. Don't Skip Out on Me started as a song. So yeah, a lot of them are linked, but with Lynette, it was so panicked. Lynette's not melancholy. She's got an edge on her. And I didn't think she had time for music. And I couldn't see my way in. And then the DeLions were working on our record, The Sea Drift. And I asked the trumpet player and keyboardist, Corey Gray, really great guy and a really amazing writer too, if he would come up with some trumpet instrumentals. And he came in with this song, and it was so beautiful. And while he was playing that,
thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Welcome to Shocks of Sheba.
Ja! For say life is an illusion. Tell me what you're thinking, Jal, provide a conclusion. Watch war on TV, believable, I mean deceiving. But what about the war crime when I claim we